Welcome to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer, producer and host of this program, and it's great to be with you. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That's an excerpt from the First Amendment, and a centerpiece for this week's program. What did our country's founders intend? Where are the lines between tolerance and acceptance? Is the U.S. a Christian nation? We'll have the answers to those questions and more in Let's Talk About Religious Freedom, an Avow Civil Conversation. Special thanks to Patty Hayes, Rachel Tobin-Smith, Marilyn Moran Townsend, and Faith Van Gilder for organizing Avow events in our community. And special thanks to Luke Hollinger and his team at Arts United for providing audio for this program. Patty Hayes was the MC for the event, and we'll hear from her shortly to introduce the panelists. Thank you for listening.
So welcome, everyone, if this is your first, and let me introduce who's on our panel. Dr. Quentin Dixie is Associate Professor of History and Religious Studies at Purdue University, Fort Wayne. He holds a BA in Urban Policy from James Madison College at Michigan State University, an MA in Religious Study, and a Doctorate in Church History from Union Theological Seminary in New York City. Trust me, by the time I'm done with this, we're all going to feel like... I went to LSU. His research interests include the African-American religious experience, religion, the civil rights movement, African-American Baptist history, and, if you didn't see Kanye this weekend, hip-hop and spirituality. A native Hoosier, Dr. Dixie spent 6 years serving on faculty of the Religious Studies Department at IU Bloomington, where he taught a wide range of courses on religion in North America. He came back to Fort Wayne in 2003 to develop a program in religious studies. I spare you the list of publications that he has authored or co-authored, but I am happy to share. Needless to say, I was duly humbled. Judge Wendy Davis is all the way on your left there. Judge Davis took the bench in 2011. She presides over felony criminal cases. I've never stood in front of her. She brought the HOPE probation program to Allen Superior Court, which has been instrumental in reducing recidivism by nonviolent, low-level drug offenders. Judge Davis was appointed by the Supreme Court to the State Judicial Probation Committee and is currently appointed to the Criminal Bench Book Committee. In 2015, Governor Mike Pence appointed Judge Davis to the newly established Indiana Governor's Task Force on Drug Enforcement, Treatment, and Prevention, where she, along with other state officials and law enforcement, helped to implement statewide solutions to the overall drug epidemic in the state. Prior to taking the bench, she was a partner at the law firm of Beckman Lawson. She was a member of Women of Excellence, the Indiana Luger Series, and received Northeast Indiana Women in Leadership Award. Thanks for joining us, Judge. And here to my right is Georgia Rahlstedt Ohmschneider. How do you do?
Good job.
I was sweating that one. Georgia is associate professor, but I'm going to skirt it. Now I'm calling her Georgia. Is associate professor of political science and campus pre-law advisor at Purdue University, Fort Wayne. A native of Fort Wayne, she did her undergraduate work at DePauw University and earned a law degree from Washington University in St. Louis, receiving graduate training in both political science and law. Dr. Ohmschneider teaches classes on civil liberties and rights, international human rights law, and the Supreme Court. With a special interest in women in politics, her research and writings are going to ensure a great panel for us this evening. So with that, we're going to start first with Judge Davis. Everyone's microphone should be hot. Give us a quick history in the Constitution in 10, 12 minutes.
Well, my name is Wendy Davis, as she said, and obviously I work for the state. I work for the government. So I know we're going to talk about separation of church and state. I take the separation of our church and state extremely seriously, and especially in what I do in the criminal justice system. I will tell you on a personal note, I'm unapologetically a Christian. I believe in the Lord Jesus Christ, and I'm unapologetically an American, and I believe in the Constitution of the United States. I only say that because that's me personally. However, I think that in our government, even in our judiciary, I can speak only for the criminal justice system, we lack diversity of thought, we lack diversity, ethnicity, we lack different religions. We are pretty much on the diversity, right? A white woman in the criminal justice system. The reason why I bring that up is because I really believe our founding fathers, when they got together, if you recall, they came over from England. How many people have just recently seen Hamilton, right? That's a great, all right, there we go, right? So even our forefathers, there was some diversity of thought there between Madison and Hamilton. I thought that was depicted really well. But when our forefathers came over, they wanted to get out from underneath England, right? England had one church. It was the Church of England. And the First Amendment really came about because I feel like, you know, they wrote the Constitution, they had the Constitutional Convention, and then they brought this thing called the Bill of Rights. And what is the Bill of Rights? It is the individual rights that we uphold as Americans. If you come in for jury duty, I talk a little bit about this because I say I'm unapologetically an American, and I take an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States of America. I take that oath very seriously. But when our founding fathers came over, they realized, okay, now we have this document called the Constitution, which is still a breathing and living document that I operate under every day in the criminal justice system. But then they thought, gosh, what about individual rights? And they started thinking about why they came over here. They wanted personal freedoms. So this lovely thing called the First Amendment, which is kind of at the root of democracy, a democratic government, said you have free speech rights, you have the free to assemble, you have a freedom to associate, you have the freedom to believe however you want to believe. And they really thought through that, and I know we're going to talk a little bit more too about the separation of church and state, because Thomas Jefferson came out, and one of the most lovely things that Thomas Jefferson said was, we need to separate church and state. Why? Because I just told you I'm unapologetically a Christian. But my law clerk, 2 years ago, was a black Muslim. I hired him. He was terrific. We have great conversations. We had civil conversations about him living in America versus me living in America. I learned what it meant to see through his lens, and it made me think differently. Do I believe differently? No. But out of such respect, I heard through his lens. And I think what Patty just said is where we in America are, I don't want to talk about politics, because that's where we're losing our founding fathers' thought process. They wanted to bring together these colonies to give us individual freedoms, yet a democratic government. And what is a democracy? It's a government run by people. So then they put this First Amendment in place, and they said, and as the people, you get to believe how you want to believe, you get to think how you want to think. We're not going to be like England and the king, and we're not going to tell you that you have to believe a certain way and think a different way. I think where we've kind of gotten lost is we don't have the ability to have these conversations, right, these civil conversations. The other thing I believe about the Constitution, and I actually wrote an op-ed about it that Julie put in the paper, and I feel is the Constitution's not an a la carte proposition. Now, I don't want to get into Second Amendment and all this. In my world, when I take an oath as your judge to follow the law, to me, I have to follow all of the Constitution, all of the amendments that go along with the Constitution. Now, I do get my guidance from the Supreme Court of the United States of America, which I follow, but it's not an a la carte proposition. My belief in America is I cannot say, I believe 100% in the First Amendment and yet turn my back on the Second Amendment. I know these are hot button issues, but that's the way our founding fathers saw it. Now, if we want to have another constitutional convention and change that, that's up to y'all. I will follow the Constitution in whatever form it is, because that's my job. Another thing, too, that I find interesting about the separation of church and state in my role is in the criminal justice system, they have done a lot of evidence-based practices that show in drug addiction and trying to turn your life around, and especially I see it in my drug addiction, that a faith-based mentoring community is needed for anybody to really get through an addiction. But that doesn't mean it has to be Christian. It can be Muslim, can be an atheist group that sits around in a circle and says, how can I help you? How can I support you? I want to be some sort of mentoring. So it wouldn't be necessarily faith-based, but that community engagement, evidence-based practices have shown really, really work. I told you what my religion is, but I will tell you I'm very careful when I am on the bench and when I am making decisions to make sure that's separated out of my view of the law and how I deal with people. Now, some people have told me, Judge Davis, I can tell you are a Christian the way you adjudicate cases. Well, maybe that's my mercy coming through because I believe in mercy when mercy is supposed to be there, right? But I also believe in punishment when accountability needs to come in and you hurt my community or you hurt others in my community and I'm going to send you to prison. But for the most part, the separation of church and state can be a really interesting thing in the government. I see a lot of our leaders forgetting that. And Thomas Jefferson thought that was so important when the Establishment Clause came out and the Free Exercise Clause. I'll take you back to your 101 constitutional cases. But those clauses are set up to say we are going to govern without necessarily bringing in whatever belief you have. We want to govern for the people. We want to govern by the people, right? So I think that these issues sometimes, in my mind, they're pretty crystal clear. But that's my profession. I have to make sure that I follow the law and follow it exactly. I'm not saying all judges do. I'm saying that's the way I operate, and that's the way I believe I'm supposed to operate under the oath that I take. So when we look now, I mean, I will tell people when they come in for jury duty, we live in the best country in the world. The United States of America is absolutely the best country in the world. Why? Because we have all these freedoms. And we lose sight of that when we get into who's our politicians and what they're saying. But if you just go back to what our forefathers grounded this country to be, we really are. If you look around the globe, if you're arrested over in some countries, you're guilty. You got to go to court and you got to prove your innocence. Not so in America. With the Constitution in place, you have the right to remain silent. You are innocent till proven guilty. You have all of these rights that so many countries don't have and that we are losing. The last thing I'll say, and then I'll turn it over to the academics, is that when it comes to First Amendment rights, I want to remind everybody, too, that we are so blessed to have those rights, because, again, in other countries, you are oppressed if you're not the country's religion, especially in the Middle East, right? We see a lot of that. Not so in America, and we got to remember that. We have to remember that when my Muslim law clerk comes in and wants to talk to me, that I listen to him, that I respect him, that I love him. And I really believe that that is what the First Amendment is all about, not fighting him. I love what Patty said, to listen, put on my listening ears, and not want to defend or not want to tell him he's wrong, right? But to really listen, because when I listen to other people, I become more educated. When I listen in politics, I do have one side. You can probably figure out what side I fall on. But I do it. But I love when I'm at lunch with my friends that are politically different than I am, because I need to hear what they're thinking, what they're feeling, what they're saying. Because for me to listen to them and know what they have First Amendment right to say whatever they want to say, I learn so much more than just my views that I see on Facebook, like Patty mentioned. So if anything, I hope you leave here tonight understanding that in America, we have this great thing called the First Amendment. There is a separation of church and state, which I wholeheartedly believe in. And for us to listen to each other, I'm sure many of you have views that are different from mine, but that I can learn from so that when I go back to my workplace, I'm not always thinking the same way, but I can see people where they're at, whether I'm sentencing them, whether it's a victim, whether it's an addict that's locked up, whatever it is. Whether it's a child molester, whatever. I see it all. But that I can at least look at this person and see the full person, view things through their lens, but then do what I think is right for the community, because ultimately that's what I have to do. So with that, I will pass it over to Quentin.
So we were asked to consider a couple of different questions. One of the questions that I dealt with was, what was the founder's intent with regards to freedom of religion and religious liberty. Now, this question for me begs another. Which founders, if by founders we mean the framers of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, then the answer is clear. Religious toleration in all its forms was their intent. The essence of their intent can be heard in the words of President Barack Hussein Obama when he said in 2010, and I quote, "This is America, and our commitment to religious freedom must be unshakable. The principle that people of all faiths are welcome in this country and that they will not be treated differently by their government is essential to who we are," end quote. But if by founders we mean those men and women that settled in the colonies nearly a century and a half before the drafting of the Constitution, then I'm not so sure. Many of those colonists arrived in the New World seeking not only economic opportunity, but also a place where they could worship their God without fear of persecution. Whether it was pilgrims in Plymouth Colony, Puritans in Massachusetts Bay, Quakers in Pennsylvania, or Catholics in Maryland, they had each experienced varying degrees of religious intoleration in Europe. And while one would think their personal stories would mean an openness to others, that is not what one finds in the history. They arrived with an axe in one hand, a gun in the other, and the Great Commission in their hearts. "Go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit." If I could take the liberty to amend scripture, to have it match the reality on the ground, it would say, "Go ye therefore and teach all nations, whether they want to be taught or not, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit." One sees the worst cases of this attitude of religious intolerance reserved for people of color. The First Nations, erroneously labeled Indians, and people of African descent. To be sure, at the heart of the civilizing imperial project lay the justification of spreading the good news to heathens far and wide. If one believes one is in possession of a word that saves souls from eternal damnation, then how can one tolerate ignorance and superstition? How can one risk the dangers of heathen traditions taking root in the family of faith? The historical record is littered with forced conversions and baptisms of enslaved Africans, all pointing to the limits of religious liberty. So, if nothing else, America from its beginning has represented a set of powerful, pervasive, and seemingly contradictory ideals. The notion of religious liberty is undergirded by our commitment to dissent. Indeed, the formation of the Republic grew out of dissent against England and the Crown. And yet, when it came to religion, conformity was just as much part of the culture as anything else. This leads us to the second question I briefly want to address, and that is this a Christian nation? While I believe it can be said unequivocally that the United States of America is not a Christian nation, one cannot deny the imprint of Christianity on this country. I'm not talking about the ways in which Christians have come to dominate life in the public sphere, so much so that before long, an American woman will need a passport to exercise the healthcare options of her choice. No, what I'm referring to are the ways certain values have been woven into the tapestry of American life and thought. One can most easily see this strand in notions of American exceptionalism. There are other values that one may argue reflect the Christian heritage of this place, including charity and volunteerism, but none so central and controversial as exceptionalism. Every time I try to explain American exceptionalism to my students, I'm reminded of a silly 2003 film, at least it seemed silly back then, called Head of State. Chris Rock was running to be the first black president of the United States. And his conservative opponent had a very simple campaign slogan: "God bless America and no place else." It seems funny, but we all know people who believe the water is a little clearer, the air a little fresher, the sun is a little brighter in this great land. Indeed, whether or not one believes God's smile is reserved for us, there can be no doubt God smiles on us in a special way. One may recall that some feared Obama. The Obama presidency signaled the end of American exceptionalism when he announced that he believed in it, but wouldn't be surprised to learn that Greeks believed in Greek exceptionalism and Brits believed in English exceptionalism. Well, if every place can be thought of as exceptional, his critics exclaimed, then no place can be exceptional. That is true, then what is our reason for being? Of course, that is not what Obama meant, and this idea of American exceptionalism would not fade so easily. Such thinking is rooted in the colonial experience. While still aboard the ship, staring out the promised land and reflecting on the goodness of God who brought him thus far, John Winthrop, the first governor of Massachusetts Bay Colony, preached to those who survived the arduous journey. This is a little bit of what Winthrop said. Thus stands the cause between God and us. We are entered into a covenant with him for this work. We have taken out a commission, but we must consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us. But if our hearts shall turn away so that we will not obey, but shall be seduced and worship other gods, our pleasures and profits, and serve them, it is propounded unto us this day that we shall surely perish out of the good land where we pass over this vast sea to possess it. That was Winthrop in 1630. Make no mistake, Winthrop sees his people as the new Israel, fresh from bondage in the land of Egypt, and prepared to enter the new land and a new covenant with God, their liberator. But to whom much is given, the scripture says, much is required. God's chosen people would have to obey God. Not some of the people, all of the people. Otherwise, God might withdraw his love, mercy, and protection. In this context, dissent or difference of belief as it relates to religion could not be tolerated. One person getting out of line threatened the colony's special relationship with God. This meant being Christian wasn't good enough. One had to be the proper type of Christian. So in 1635, Roger Williams was banished from Massachusetts Bay for spreading, quote unquote, new and dangerous opinions, end quote. Today, we would simply call him a Baptist. But then he was called dangerous. Williams founded the colony of Providence, which later became Rhode Island, and immediately declared it open to religious dissenters, a place where people would be free to follow their conscience. Anne Hutchinson joined him shortly thereafter, when she too was banished for her religious beliefs. Despite all this freedom of expression, it wasn't until 1842 that Jews were allowed to vote in Rhode Island. And by Jews, of course, I mean Jewish men. Peter Stuyvesant, director of the Company of New Amsterdam, which later became New York, was very worried about the potential of Jews infecting the community. He went so far as to refer to them as, quote, deceitful, repugnant enemies of the name of Christ, end quote. Moreover, he was concerned that admitting Jews to New Amsterdam might mean something negative for supporting proper Christian teaching. By proper, Stuyvesant meant the Dutch Reformed Church. After all, letting Jews in meant one would have to admit Catholics, Lutherans, and even Quakers. Despite the Enlightenment rationalism of the framers of the Constitution, centuries later, the worst of the tradition of American exceptionalism continues to read our story through the lens of intolerance and bigotry. Whether it is efforts to ban an entire religion from entry to the rise of white Christian nationalism, the Christian character of America has been a blessing, but most recently, a curse.
It's so interesting to me because I love the fact that we all have slightly different careers and slightly different focus. You can tell from Judge Davis, her look at this as a judge. You can tell what Dr. Dixie Quinton says and his background in religious studies. And when I was asked to be involved in this kind of conversation, if you will, remember what I do, I'm a political scientist. So I thought, oh, what could be bad about this conversation? Religion and politics, what could go wrong? Because when I looked at the questions and thought about it, both with a background in law and a background in political science, The framers, in many ways, were thinking, what is the place of religion in public life? And that particular question is the kind of overarching umbrella question of all the other ones. Is it a Christian nation? What about intolerance? What is separation of church and state? And both Quentin and I didn't know exactly what Dr. Dixie and Judge Davis were going to talk about, and I'm not going to repeat too much, but simply to be remindful of things. Because, again, as Dr. Dixie said, when people came to the United States during the colonial period, after independence, tolerance was not always something that was the norm, shall we say. Intolerance was, in a way, the norm. And besides the issues related to voting, and I believe Quentin talked about in New York, talked about in, what'd you say, Delaware, et cetera, Rhode Island, vis-a-vis the Jews, there were also established churches in a number of the colonies, now states. In fact, Massachusetts had an established church, the Congregational Church, until 1833. And that gets to kind of the second part. So was this supposed to be a Christian nation, in a way? And what Judge Davis talked about. Clearly, if you look at the Constitution only references religion once. It references it in this fact, that there shouldn't be a religious test for office. Now, that's something that wasn't true in the colonies and many states. The other part of the Constitution is the part that was added later, as Judge Davis said, the First Amendment, specifically the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. That's it. So what were those framers doing? Well, for one thing, remember the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law. So the Constitution of the United States, both in terms of religious test and the First Amendment, established and free exercise, only applied against the national government. So for many years, those concerns that Quentin was talking about, the establishment, if you wonder why, how could Massachusetts have an established church? It's because the federal constitution did not protect against state establishment. What happened eventually is there was a change. When the 14th Amendment to the Constitution happened at the Civil War, eventually, and it was quite eventually, you had the Supreme Court say, the 14th Amendment applies some, but not all, of the Bill of Rights to the states. So finally, after that, you had the application of the Bill of Rights also to the states. Now, that didn't happen until 1947 and the 1950s, okay, where that application fully occurred. So in thinking about what did the framers, what was their intent? What did they want? What did separation mean clearly, etc.? Well, there were differences, both with religious test, separation of church and state, and free exercise. Differences with the states. Clearly, they did not want religion to be, in all measure, a test of citizenship. When it came to voting, when it came to holding office, and when it came to other civil rights, at least at the federal level. Now, you see the application to the states later on. So, I guess my job is to talk a little bit more about what is separation of church and state, if you will. A word or a phrase that you kind of hear a lot. The first thing that I want to point out is a little bit about Thomas Jefferson. Because usually when people talk about separation of church and state, most people think of the Establishment Clause. But Thomas Jefferson actually suggested the separation of church and state encompasses not only the Establishment Clause, but encompasses the Free Exercise Clause as well. He wrote that the legislature that said, make no laws respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state. So it's actually a little wider, at least in Jefferson's mind, than we think of in modern terms, because we usually think of just the Establishment Clause with kind of separation between church and state. Now let's talk a little bit. Okay, what does that mean? Okay, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. Separation of church and state. Does that mean government supporting religion? But what's supporting religion? I think a lot of people would agree on the idea of government supporting religion. What's exactly supporting? Is supporting aiding religion with money, with other ways, directly, indirectly? Does there have to be coercion involved? Is it just when a government endorses a religion? What happens when there are individuals involved that are not religious at all, suggesting, wait a minute. Now, what has happened over time is the Supreme Court has answered the question, what is separation of church and state, differently. And it's not surprising. One might say, well, there are different justices on the court. And different justices might have different ideology, and we can talk about but there's also other things. It's different periods of time and what is going on in the larger political social environment that helps frame how that question is answered. It's arguably also the very specific facts of the case make a difference in the answer to the question. So really, the first case that starts off answering the question is a case that involves a situation in which New Jersey wanted to reimburse parents when they paid for transportation to parochial schools. In the case, they were Catholic schools, the Everson case. And if you've ever read the case, Justice Black, who, if you know anything about Justice Black, was seen as a literalist. And so the expectation was that he would strike this down. This is aid. This is aid. You're reimbursing, in effect, these parents for sending their children to, in this case, a Catholic school. And he talked a long time in his opinion about the high wall of separation between church and state. But at the end, he found in favor of the parents, in favor of reimbursement, under a child benefit theory. And a lot of people have looked back in time. What does that mean? What does that tell us about how the court found meaning? Well, one thing we know is I want you to think of the time period, 1947. It's the beginning of the Cold War, the war against godless communist Soviet Union. That's also the time period where Under God was officially added to the Pledge of Allegiance. And it is a time period in which Catholic Americans were now more integrated into the larger American community, in part through a participation in World War II. And so the court found its way to say, this isn't direct aid, this is indirect aid. Its direct aid is the meaning of, if you will, respecting the establishment of religion. Then comes the 1960s, a time of a different court. This court, it saw a higher wall. It tended to strike down most things when cases were brought up to the court. Bible reading, prayer in public schools, etc. By the 1970s, you had a justice on the court, a chief justice called Chief Justice Warren Burger, who somehow wanted to bring these disparate parts of the court together, all these disparate precedents. And he developed this test called the Lemon Test out of a case called Lemon versus Kurtzman that I'm not going to go into great detail. But it had various parts to it. Now, at first, people were somewhat satisfied with this test, but then came religious display cases in the 1980s, where you had creches and nativity scenes in public parks, along with Frosty and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and Santa Claus and all the stuff. And you had individuals saying, wait a minute, you can't put a nativity scene in a government park. That violates the Establishment Clause. You're aiding religion, or it violates the Lemon Test. It violates something. The result was, in the case, that the court found in that particular case, Lynch versus Donnelly, that the nativity scene with Frosty and the candy canes and a variety of other things was in fact constitutional. It didn't respect the establishment of religion. It didn't violate separation of church and state. Now, in the process, that case pleased no one, and the Lemon Test pleased no one, which was the test that was used. Why? Because the people arguing in support of the nativity scene were people arguing it's perfectly all right to have a nativity scene. It is representative of the United States religious heritage. The people opposed to the nativity scene agreed that it was religious, but it had no business in there. Justice Burger suggested the nativity scene had lost its religious significance. You can imagine, people on many sides were not happy with that. And it was kind of, it began a slow kind of movement. Okay, what does the Establishment Clause mean? The Supreme Court tries to come up with these different tests to kind of tease out the meaning. Justice Scalia, bless his heart, who was kind of famous for his, regardless of whether you agreed with him, famous for his quips, talked about how the Lemon Test and its use in public display cases was better for interior designers than jurors. What has happened now is the Supreme Court has, in fact, settled on the idea that separation of church and state in terms of the Establishment Clause means that there should be neutrality between different religions, between religion and non-religion. They use the endorsement clause, the endorsement test of O'Connor a lot. And the other kind of test that's used is from another case in which history and tradition, if this display's been around a lot, it's historical, it's okay. It has more than one meaning.
The next portion of the program will feature a Q&A and talk back from the audience.
I have one question as we're getting people with microphones to give you all a chance to ask some questions too. Each of you at some point kind of used the word tolerance because of its use in our founding documents. Is tolerance enough? Tolerance as opposed to acceptance? Inclusion? Was that the intent? You used it first, Dr. Dixie. I'll let you.
Yeah, you answered.
think tolerance was the intent. And that's what we're always trying to figure out. What the heck did they mean? We see what they say. What does it mean? And I think very clearly at this point, they intended toleration because acceptance meant, in some cases for them, agreement. You know, and Jefferson made it very clear, hey, I can disagree with you till the cows come home, but I'm going to defend your right to say stuff that I think is stupid. And so tolerance is that notion that indeed we give people enough room to say things that may be completely other than what we might support, but acceptance leads us more towards saying, not only do I have to give you an opportunity to say it, to some degree I have to accept the validity of it. And that was something that I don't think Jefferson intended.
I think the way I read the Constitution, what I know of the Founding Fathers, I'm not probably academically as sound as they are, but I did have to go to a graduate program I had to read all the Madison's papers, I had to read them all. And I really believe that when our Founding Fathers thought, maybe not so much acceptance, but definite inclusion. And I think that when I look even in our government today, we don't have enough inclusion that I believe the Constitution requires me. I work in the government to do. Tolerance, maybe, I like the way, Quentin, you said acceptance, because I was going to say acceptance, right? Because I can disagree with you, but I can still accept you as a person. I can accept you as my colleague. I can accept you as someone who I'm having lunch with and having a friendship with. But that doesn't necessarily mean, it's kind of what I go back to when I would talk to my law clerk who was Muslim and from the African American community. He grew up very differently than I did. To your point, I didn't accept everything he necessarily said as truth, but boy, I really accepted him and I respected him greatly.
Anybody have any questions? I recently listened to a lecture on American history, and the professor made the point that in the beginning of our settlement, read is common here, for those who came to America seeking religious freedom and into their persecution, religion was central to their entire belief system and worldview. Almost by definition then, they could not conceive of another belief system as valid. And that was kind of our starting point. And the only reason the separation of church and state was promoted was that there was no predominant religion in the U.S., so it was a defensive mechanism to protect them from these other religions. So if you could comment on that.
Well, kind of certainly, you probably know that after independence, the states had no central government for a while. And then between 1781 and 1787, our first constitution, the Articles of Confederation, left most authority in the states. And when you left most authority in the states, as Quentin pointed out, and I kind of threw my little part in about the established churches as well, you had this huge variety, both established churches and various states deciding which religious faiths were appropriate to allow those individuals that were the adherents of those faith just to be full citizens, to be able to vote, to be able to be on a jury, to be able to hold office, etc. And so when the Articles of Confederation, obviously were in the second constitution, so the first one didn't work so good, came into being for a number of reasons that there needed to be a bigger central government. I think just by virtue of that. And remember, the Constitution was only for the national government for a long time, and so it only involved a religious test for office. One needs to kind of remember that a little bit. So I think there's truth to it, and it's that kind of history, not only of the colonies, the post-independence, the states, the notion of who gets to be a citizen in all measure, and then the problem with the Articles of Confederation, too.
I think it's hard for us to get our heads around today just what was at stake for people in their religious commitment. They really did believe that if we didn't do what God expected of us somehow, the nation is going to be punished. So they saw this as a two-way covenant. We have a responsibility to uphold our commitment to our religious laws, the process of doing so, God keeps his end of the bargain. But we got to hold up ours. When it comes to establishment, many of the colonies did see one particular religion as a favorite, but then had a list of official ones. Jefferson's 1788-89 things with the Bill of Rights actually started in Virginia a good 10 years earlier with those Baptists once again, right? Baptists running around preaching without a license, right? And refusal to get one because they're not going to allow the state to tell them because God has told them they can say these things. The state can't interfere. Well, Virginia had a list of approved religions and Baptists weren't among them. And all the ones that were on the list as approved also got state funding, right? Patrick Henry was the one who really promoted this in Virginia, partly out of fear that if the government didn't support the churches, they wouldn't have enough money to keep going. So that was one of the motivations behind establishment in Virginia.
And the devil is in the details in who's considered a Christian. You know, well into, I think it was in the 1900s, then Teddy Roosevelt had to defend William Howard Taft, who was to be the President of the United States and later the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in the 1930s, because he wasn't a Christian, he was a Unitarian. And so, you know, the devil is in the details, as they say in a lot of ways.
I have an observation and a question, and I apologize, they're not really related, but I find it interesting that a couple of you refer to the fathers the founding fathers, and then you, Professor, refer to the framers. I think there's something sort of that speaks to the way you view the Constitution or how that's been, especially with what Dr. Dixon said in the beginning about who are the founding fathers really. So I just think that's an interesting observation, and if you want to talk about that, that's fine. But I can hear it in your language, and so that affects your approach, I think. And then the question is, in terms of aid or separation of church and state, how do you feel about tax-exempt status for organized religions or for organized churches? Does that somehow violate church and state principles?
When you talk about tax-exempt status, I think that, for me, that does not mean the government is supporting a religion, because it's equality, right? If you're a 501c3, you get that equal status. So it's not like there's tax-exempt status for a Catholic church and not for the Muslim mosque. If they live in America, the way our laws are set up, I believe, the tax-exempt status, I have been through, since I've been on the bench, they send us to all kinds of different kind of law classes, right? And ours is more to get to the root of equal justice for all. So understand that's my lens and how I've been taught, especially if you read the Federalist Papers, which I had to read every one of them, and all of that, you really see that through Madison's eyes. But I believe that, directly to your question, that as long as you're doing it equally across the board for all religions, all people, all ethnicities, I think that that does not in any way, shape, or form allow the government to support the religion. I think, in fact, it allows lots of different religions to be accepted, I don't know if that's the right word, by our country.
I'm all for it, as long as religious organizations don't think somehow they're special, right? I think the challenge comes when you claim tax-exempt status, and along with that, you can't promote religion in particular ways, especially when it comes to politics, right? But then when religious organizations turn around and try to somehow single themselves out as being different from other organizations, you can't have it both ways, right? If you're a 501c3, you have to obey these kinds of rules. And it's not because you're religious, it's because you're a not-for-profit organization. So the courts should treat you like any other not-for-profit organization, right? Where are your bylaws? Where are your articles? Right, these are the things we're going to, I don't care what the Bible says in this regard. What does Article 3 of your bylaws say about how you fire a pastor? That's what we're going by, you know, not scripture. So you can't have it both ways. If you're going to get the tax exempt status, you then have to follow the legal requirements for that.
My question, I'll just say it two different ways. first of all, do we have a problem? And maybe the second way of saying it, can you name a city or a county or a state or a federal law today that goes against that proposition to not separate church and state, that combines church and state? Is this just a question that is looking for a problem, or a problem that's looking for...
So your question is there a law right now that violates the constitutional value of our First Amendment freedom of religion?
And a city, county, state, or federal, because of your point that in 57 it only was federal. So any law today in America that violates that principle?
I would pass it over to the professors. I don't know of any. You have to remember, too, that the First Amendment does not apply to private organizations. The First Amendment's only applicable to government action, right? So I don't know of any law, county, because if so, if there could be. I'm sure somewhere in some little town there is, and it will stay that way until somebody challenges it. That's how we get court cases up to the Supreme Court. You have to file a lawsuit saying this ordinance or this violation or, you know, is unconstitutional. So if there is a law, I don't know of any. There's none that I see on the books that are coming out of state government or federal government, which are the appellate higher courts that I have to follow. But I just, as we're having this discussion, I just want to make sure that everybody's reminded that all of the laws, you know, you can have a private organization, unfortunately, and discriminate. I mean, now there's civil rights acts and those kind of things that you can bring private lawsuits. So those private lawsuits would be, my company's getting sued based on religious discrimination or ethnic, but as far as the First Amendment is concerned, that's only applicable to government. And I don't know of any laws unless you do.
To me, it's not so much about the law, it's about the way people interpret the law. It's not necessarily about the law itself, right? I went through Lutheran schools, K through 12, right? Concordia system, as a Baptist. I mean, I had enough beef stroganoff and sauerkraut to last a lifetime. But one of the things that really confused me is like sixth grade. It says right there in the Bible, take, eat, this is, right? It doesn't say it represents, stands in the place of, this is my body, right? And I went home and told my dad, who's a Baptist minister, that doesn't really mean is, right? We don't believe that. That's why we use grape juice in communion, because it doesn't really matter, because that's not really what it means, right? So I think this is where we get into laws versus interpretations of laws. There may not be any laws in the books that violate it, but people find ways to kind of skirt it, right, without violating it. For 1 year, I had my children in public schools, and I was just really confused by the religious ed trailers. The religious education trailers that pulled up alongside the school, and the kids could go out of the school either in the parking lot or just on the street level and get religious education during school hours. And of course, religious ed, the trailer was sponsored by the Associated Churches of Allen County, didn't teach religious ed, it taught Christian ed. And the way the form that you had to sign for consent was written, if you were a Muslim immigrant registering your kid, you had no idea that you just signed your kid up to go out to the stinking trailer. Is that a violation? I don't know. Did they break a law? I mean, there were some lawsuits, you know, certainly against that. I know when I think the Jewish Federation complained about it, and Associated Churches said, you don't like it, get your own dang trailer. What? That's not the response we were looking for. So I'm not sure if it's a violation, but certainly an interpretation, a wiggle around.
I think what it was is in the 1950s, there were a set of cases involving religious education in the school building itself. That was considered direct aid. But when you released people out to, and that's when kids could still walk to their temple, to their church, etc., that was okay because you weren't directly aiding in the building itself. At least that was the theory. I can tell you that I think, again, in Alabama, a case is going to come up about putting a monument involving the Ten Commandments in the courthouse. There have been two other occasions where that has been struck down as unconstitutional. I believe that is up on the books again.
So we the people of succeeded in that we don't allow legislators to make laws that, I get this backwards, that separate church and state, but combine church.
It goes back to checks and balances. Our Congress, like if you had a congressman that were making those laws, I guarantee you the Supreme Court would take it over and say it's unconstitutional. That goes back to the balance of power, the checks and balances with executive, legislative, and judicial. I think we do a great job of that in our country. It's not perfect, but I think we do a great job in our country doing that.
I think it's not necessarily just a matter of laws that may be in effect. But also practices. I belong to the American Humanist Association, mm-hmm. and they spend a fair amount of energy dealing with various practices that seem to inject religion, specifically Christianity, mm-hmm. into a number of governmental functions. For instance, Christian prayers before city council meetings and that sort of thing, as well as the issue of the Ten Commandments monuments, which, by the way, apparently were spread around quite a bit by Cecil D. DeMille as a PR thing to advertise his movie with Charlton Heston. So it's the practices that are being injected into some of our governmental functions that I think happen more often than trying to pass specific laws.
Mm-hmm. We have a question over here. No. So I am a person of faith. And I think one of the things that I try so hard to do is to make sure that I treat my friends who don't have faith equally to my friends that do. I think that's very important. My concern, and I just wanted to get your opinion, is that I feel that some of those conversations that we're having, we currently, the nativity situation is happening in Fulton County right now, with a gentleman who wasn't from our county who was offended by the nativity scene in our courthouse. It's been there for 30 plus years, most of my life. But he became offended, and so it's a huge topic of conversation. Mm-hmm. What I worry about is that topic of conversation is actually dividing us in a way that we can no longer have intelligent and team-related conversations about religion. I feel that it's caused us to be against each other. I get so irritated by the mad faces for or against. So how do we...
If we could solve that problem, we would be a perfect nation, because that's what's going on. Is the nativity scene in your yard?
It is. So it's been there for, well, like I said, I'm 40, so for 30 right. plus years. The Optimist Club, actually. So it's not a church that does it. It's the Optimist Club. I don't even know how they began to do it.
But it's in your personal property yard.
It is in the courthouse yard.
Courthouse.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. I thought you said your personal property.
The courthouse yard. So in the Fulton County Courthouse Yard. And yeah. So it had been something that had been a tradition. But in addition, so there's a Santa house that is with it. There's reindeer and lights and Christmas trees. You know, the whole thing. And so, but it's become such a polarizing conversation. I just think to myself, can't we just get back to the business of figuring out how to respect each other? I don't know if we can do that.
Well, it goes back to tolerance, collaboration, acceptance, all of these things, and I think 100% you're correct, because I don't take offense. If I have a nativity scene in the courthouse yard, which is my belief, and someone, I mean, I don't believe the Muslims believe in Christmas, but if they want to come put something out there as well, that's just a part of my community. So I think you're right. I think we get so intolerant of each other's personal views and freedoms of religion and First Amendment rights. It's where our nation is right now. I'm in politics, both state and federal, and I'm telling you that's where we are. But I really think it comes down to, if you want to have a nativity scene, put as a community, if you've got, I mean, we have a big Burmese population here, you know, and they celebrate different things at different times. During their celebrations, let's give them the opportunity to put their stuff up. I agree with you, but I think if we could solve that, we probably would have more going on in Washington, D.C., but...
As a person of faith also, I think about African-American theologian Howard Thurman, who said that it's so much easier to worship Jesus than it is to follow Jesus. And if we spent more time trying to follow Jesus, you know, asking the question, what would Jesus do? You know, maybe we could think about a way to work around this. Think about Gandhi when India was claiming independence. And of course, all the Hindu nationalists were saying, of course, we should be in charge,
right? And what are we going to do about these Muslims, the minority group? Mm-hmm. And Ghani's like, let them lead, right? We're the majority. Why wouldn't we? Of course, they got him killed. I forgot that part. But
he did it in love, is your point.
Exactly.
Yeah, he did it in love.
And, you know, I think there's a scripture about, you know, if meat offendeth thy brother, do not eat. You know, is your fate at stake in the stinking nativity scene?
It's also, I think it's important to remember, and sometimes it gets forgotten too. It's when you're a person of at least the general faith, that's the dominant faith, it is hard to walk in someone else's shoes. Christmas isn't that meaningful for them, let alone a person not of faith. And so it's hard to kind of think about that, where everything's closed and everything, things like that as well. And many times, at least the Supreme Court, in many of its early decisions that involved free exercise, it was always involving individuals of minority faith. And so a lot of those early decisions involved that very issue. And so to just kind of think about it a little bit in those terms, you know what I mean?
Last question there.
I have a question about the separation of church and state and the wall that has kind of shrinking. And
I did that. I would like to have you speak about vouchers in which state money from our legislature goes to support private schools, and how that was decided to be okay by the Supreme Court.
Yes.
Because we're doing this on radio broadcasts, let me repeat the question in terms, and our last question, if we can be brief, just comment on vouchers and state funds going to parochial schools.
You wanted to do Indiana. You're an Indiana person.
Well, so. I can tell you the thought process behind it a little bit in our Supreme Court. All parochial schools are not religious-based schools. Right, so they're all private schools. So you have private and public, right? So I don't think it's a religious issue, and I think that's what came out of our legislature, and that's what came out of our Supreme Court.
But it is a religious issue. Well, because most of that money goes to parochial schools. The far majority goes to parochial.
I know there's a lot of schools here accepting vouchers that are not religious schools, and so I can only tell you. Not my personal opinion, I can tell you the thinking behind it is that it was a way to get some kids that they felt were having inequality in learning, to get them the opportunities that they could not otherwise have. So the state stepped in, per the Supreme Court, the state stepped in and said, we're gonna give this money to the parents so that you, since you don't have the means that maybe Quentin does for his kids to send them to, where'd you say Concordia? You know, he's got the means to do that. There's some children that are so unequal. The religious aspect of it was not a part of it. It was more equality. And I can just say that I work with so many of our urban youth here in Fort Wayne, Indiana. If I could get half of them vouchers to get to a better school, I would. That does not have anything to do with religion, as it has to do with better education for some children that don't have the opportunity to do it.
So, go ahead.
That's a whole lot of civil conversation.
I mean, in terms of Cleveland, the Cleveland court followed the old Everson case of a child benefit theory in which the aid was considered direct to the parents and children and indirect to the parochial schools. The justices in that case were willing to accept there was indirect aid to religious schools, but it was not direct. They used child benefit. They also are using, as I said before, I've said it a million times, the new approach is both endorsement but neutrality. As long as there's neutrality between religions, and the money is given out to all religions and schools that aren't religion, the court, as of this time, is saying that's enough. The court in the 1970s would say no. It doesn't pass the Lemon Test.
It'd be interesting to see if Fort Wayne, if we had a Muslim school open up at the mosque here in Maumee and apply for vouchers to see how people would respond to the voucher program in that situation. And it always confuses me that you say, okay, this particular public school is not a good public school, partly because they don't have any money, and then you take money. All right, I'm done.
Okay. Actually, our first civil conversation was on vouchers, and that might be time to bring it back around again. It's still a strong issue. Before we move into our civil conversation groups, please thank the panelists. They're going to stay around.
Yeah, thank you.
The questions have been spectacular, and I hope it's given you thought that will help guide your table for a little more discussion. We've covered a lot of different issues. Our tradition here is we're going to take, it's almost 7 o'clock, so we're going to take a shorter 20 minutes for you to have some conversation at the table. The panelists will go around and circulate, spend a little time. But within your table, have that conversation. Is this a Christian nation? We've heard it from each of the speakers. We've touched on it. And I want to have each of you have a chance to have that conversation at your table. So we'll give you a five-minute warning and then report out to our tables. Thank you. Is this a Christian nation? Any common ground? Was there anything that your table could agree on in their discussions?
Our general conclusion was that because this was very much a balancing act between a whole range of opinions, they purposely kept it somewhat vague, again, and also searching for that common ground that they had to be able to create this new country that was much different than anything else up to that point. So being able to find that common ground is probably a good lesson for us today as well.
I think that we ended up saying that in a way we're a Christian nation because Christian is being Christ-like and moral, but so are Muslims and so are Buddhists, and so we are a moral nation, therefore Christian, therefore all those others that I just said. But we boiled it down in a way of saying that we're a civic and a civil nation. And if you want to go ahead and use the word Christ-like or Buddhist-like or Muslim-like or Christian, then you can use that. But if we boiled it down to kind of we're a nation of similar morality. None of us think that murder, just murdering this guy right here, is a good thing. So in a way, we're a civilized nation.
Real quick, so I think we also decided that civility requires space for everybody, and that requires moving and shifting. Like, at some point, some people are going to have to be vulnerable and be able to move into their own space, and in order to allow somebody to do that, you're going to have to move back and listen, and also take what they say, reflect, and then see how it affects you and how you can help. So it's just being more flexible and fluid and empathetic, so...
And I think the other thing is being willing to see people and meet them where they are. I think that my experience versus his is going to be different, especially even the race. And we get scared to touch that stuff. But that is the fact that certain things have shifted and changed the way we think and feel as individual different groups. And so that was a big conversation for us. The question he asked, are we a moral nation? Which really brought our table to everybody's hand and was like, yes.
I'm not going to make anybody report out. Others?
Our table really had trouble because we felt the question wasn't defined. So what is the definition of a Christian nation? And so we had a little bit of trouble, but we did end up finding out that we have many more Christians than any other religion, but the nones are coming up in the statistics. So what, 70% Christian? So we kind of just looked at the numbers, and it was quite interesting. But we really wished it, you know, like it was better defined, because like Iraq, they have a national religion. We do not.
We spent some time in discussion about whether we are a Christian nation or whether we were a nation of Christians, and kind of came into different places, but there was a lot of common ground, I think, in our group. We think that we, once upon a time, were much more a nation of Christians, but because so many of our principles have been founded on Christianity, that there is more feeling of being a Christian nation than that of any other type of religion or any other belief. Although many Christians don't believe that it is any longer a Christian nation. So it's a little bit circular, but we feel like that there's a lot of intrinsic Christian value, for better or for worse, but that we have moved away from becoming a nation of Christians, if that makes sense.
So we kind of came to the consensus that we're a melting pot of religious and spiritual practices across the whole board. You know, obviously there's a huge predominant Christian majority, but we're kind of moving away from that. And while that's happening, we have a growing millennial population that's becoming more accepting of, you know, different religious or non-religious and spiritual beliefs that's helping the younger generation come together. But for the older generation, there's a lot of, you know, contempt and unwillingness to understand different religions. And that's kind of what is keeping us from coming together. You know, one of our members said that we have open language in our laws, but closed practices, and that's how, you know, we operate.
We had an interesting conversation here, starting with the Christian nation and actually kind of circling back around to language. One of the things that I felt like was very important, or that we felt was very important, and I'll let the folks at the table agree or disagree with me, was looking at understanding that we are maybe not a Christian nation anymore. Folks of faith accepting that, but then how do we not tolerate each other? Because that was the term that was offensive. But what would it be if we actually communicated with each other? And we came up with the word, this young lady right here came up with the word, respecting each other. So if we could respect different belief systems, then we actually could have, and we had a very good conversation at this table, even though I think many of us are very passionate. This young man instituted a talking stick, which was very helpful, but respect was what we came to, was having respectful conversation, which was, you know, instituted by the talking stick.
Thank you all for coming this evening. I know there's so many opportunities for people to share their times and community on a rainy night. Pat yourself on the back. Thank you for, because without you, our goals of having civil conversations can't happen. So thank you, everyone.
This has been an episode of WBOI Presents. Special thanks to Avow founders Patty Hayes, Rachel Tobin-Smith, Marilyn Moran Townsend, and Faith Van Gilder for organizing this event. And special thanks to Luke Hollinger and his team at Arts United for providing audio for this program. Additional episodes of WBOI Presents can be found at WBOI.org. Our music is by Mark Waldick and Noah Campodonico. Our web producer is Loyal Vandenberg. Our WBOI intern is Brittany Smith. Until next time, thank you for listening. From WBOI Fort Wayne.